This is the Oral History Review's contribution to the OUP blog. I'm here with Roger Davis Gatchett. And what we're trying to do is allow the authors of our articles, in this case, an article that appeared in Volume 39, Issue 2 of the Oral History Review, and I'll let Roger give you the long title of it, give them space to talk a little bit more about their piece. So Roger, if you wouldn't mind giving yourself a better introduction than I just did, and if you wouldn't mind, too, listing the title of your piece.
Sure. It's I've Got Some Antique in Me, The Discourse of Authenticity and Identity in the African-American Blues Community in Austin, Texas. That's a mouthful there. I'm currently a assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Eastern New Mexico University in Portales, New Mexico, and did my graduate work in communication studies, more specifically rhetorical studies, at the University of Texas at Austin. And also continue to volunteer as an oral historian for the Project in Interpreting the Texas Past, which is a oral history project in Austin, Texas.
Great. Thank you, Roger. First question today is, what drew you to oral history?
Yeah, well, you know, I've always enjoyed doing interviews, you know, regardless of the purpose or the context. And prior to my study of oral history, for several years I volunteered as a disc jockey for various student radio stations where I hosted blues programs and had the opportunity to interview lots of blues musicians live on the air when I was doing that. And for a while I hosted my first blues show at KCPR, which is a student station at Cal Poly State University in San Luis Obispo, California. And their claim to fame, I always like to tell people, is that Weird Al Yankovic, when he was an architecture student there, was a radio DJ at that same station. He recorded his single My Bologna in the bathroom right across the hall from the radio station. But I used to do a lot of interviews with musicians there, and also have worked as a contributing writer for Living Blues magazine, which has given me another sort of creative outlet to publish interviews with artists. And, you know, and going back even further, in high school, my U.S. history class, we had an assignment where we were asked to interview members of our family who had lived through the Great Depression, which I really enjoyed. So I guess I've been doing oral history for a long time now, even before I was even aware of the term or that it existed as a field or a method. But I was drawn to oral history when I took a graduate seminar on oral narratives as a doctoral student at the University of Texas at Austin. And it was taught by Martha Norkunis, whose name I'm sure many of those listening to this podcast will recognize. And that seminar was really formative for me, I guess, you know, and two of the oral history interviews actually that I conducted for that class made it into my piece for the Oral History Review. And after that semester, I started volunteering as an oral historian for that project in Interpreting the Texas Past that I just mentioned a second ago, which Dr. Norkunis started and directed when she was still teaching there at UT Austin. So that's how I got into oral history.
Roger, that's great. I have a follow-up. Is there a plaque in that bathroom saying that Weird Al recorded here?
There should be. There absolutely should be. But no, it's one of those sort of old station lore, I guess, and it keeps getting passed down as all narratives do, I guess, in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
There may be one. There wasn't when I was there, but maybe someone's put a plaque up there now.
Yeah, well,
good
maybe,
acoustics, you know, in bathrooms.
Right. Maybe the contribution to this podcast will be to stimulate somebody there to create a plaque for Weird Al.
I hope so. I think it's an important part of the history of the place, or at least an interesting little fact, that's for sure.
Thanks again. So our next official question is, so what led you to write the article?
Well, this article is actually part of a larger book-length project that I'm working on, which addresses the rhetorical construction of authenticity in the blues and popular culture more broadly. But this article was originally a chapter in that larger project, and I felt with some revisions it could work well as a standalone article. And given its focus on oral history and authenticity, it seemed like something that would be of particular interest to the readers of Oral History Review. You know, the concept of authenticity, which is really at the core of this piece, you know, what it means, how we negotiate it, how we struggle over it, I think is central to the work that oral historians do. You know, oral historians, I think they experience in a deep, even intimate sense, something we might think of or we like to think of as authenticity whenever, you know, whenever we sit down with a narrator and he or she shares their life story with us. And there's something about the commitment to orality in our work that I think is akin to a struggle or search for authenticity as well. And so, you know, when I started doing these oral history interviews with blues musicians in Austin, Texas, I knew that I wanted to write about authenticity in the blues. So I made sure to ask them questions that revolved around that. And in all honesty, I really had no idea how they would respond, if they would be open to discussing authenticity, or if it was even, you know, if it was even a concept that they considered important in their lives and music. And I was quite surprised to find that they did, in fact, have quite a bit to say about it, and that their constructions of authenticity followed similar patterns, right? With everybody I interviewed, I started noticing connections with the way they defined it, you know, compared to other artists I spoke with. So I think their narratives give us special insight into how authenticity is negotiated in this particular blues community in Austin. And so really, I just wanted to share that with others in the hopes that it might generate or start a larger conversation about authenticity in the field of oral history.
Thanks, Roger. So I got a follow-up to that. So was it a question about authenticity that led to the first half of the title of the piece, I've Got Some Antique in Me?
Yes. Well, yes, actually it did. That was that came from an interview I did with James Kirkendall. And I still remember very vividly when he said that line. We were talking about, you know, what it means to be an authentic blues musician, right, and how you would distinguish between someone who's authentic or not authentic in his mind. And Kirkendall, as I mentioned in the article, really defined authenticity according to one's lived experience. It was very much a class-based definition or argument, you know, that is to say you can't play the blues authentically unless you've lived a blues life. You know, you've gone hungry, didn't have clothes to wear, you know, been through romantic troubles and all of those sorts of things. And so he was just sort of talking about it, and he said, you know, I've got some antique in me. He said, that's the word I like to use. I've got some antique in me that I can use, which is to say, you know, he's been around. He's an antique. He's been around, and he's lived that hard life. And the second that he said that, I you know, made a note to myself saying that's a line that I'm going to end up using someday in the future if I ever publish this or do something with it. And sure enough.
And was he one of the two artists who we were able to feature his song in the piece?
Absolutely, yes. The track is called what is it called? I'm forgetting. Kirkendall's Groove or something like that. It's sort of an instrumental kind of groove tune. But yes, one of the tracks that we were able to get permission to post digitally with the digital version of the article is by James Kirkendall.
So I think it's called Kirk's Back?
Kirk's Back, that's the one. Yep, Kirk's Back.
Okay. If this were Fresh Air, we would now be playing that song, but it's actually going it's actually in the piece and is available so people will be able to read it and then listen to the two songs at the end of it.
I had a colleague of mine, this is kind of off topic, but a colleague of mine at Eastern New Mexico University here saw the title for my article, but he only saw the first half of it, and he thought I was writing about antiques. The second half is very important.
Right. Right. You were tapping into the big antiquing craze in Austin. All right, so the third official question is, so are there things that you want to say in this piece, but either didn't or couldn't?
Oh, sure. You know, as you know, and I'm sure all the folks listening to this will know, the space limitations that we all work under in journal publishing always requires us to leave something out. I mean, it's sort of the nature of the beast. You know, in my article, I focused on four African-American artists who all discussed authenticity in similar ways, but I also interviewed a number of white musicians in Austin who, you know, just because of space limitations, didn't make it into that the published version. And what's really interesting is they defined authenticity very differently from the musicians that I did interview. So, you know, whereas the African-American artists I discussed in that essay, Henry Blues Boy Hubbard, Matthew Robinson, James Kirkendall, and Charles Shaw, all referenced blackness as a principal signifier of blues authenticity, the white musicians I interviewed argued that one's musical ability was really the defining feature of authenticity in the blues. And they were careful to note that for them, at least, that ability was not tied to any specific racial category. You know, put more simply, you can play the blues authentically if you can play it, you know, and play it correctly, and play it with feeling. So that was an interesting and I think significant difference, because I saw that almost exclusively, that sort of, you know, definition based on one's musical ability was really coming almost exclusively from the white musicians that I interviewed. And so that's something I would have liked to have discussed, you know, in the published version, but was not able to.
Thanks, Roger. You may have alluded to this in some of your answers, but I'll ask this question directly. So what would you like readers to gain from the piece?
Well, I think two main things, and first, I hope that readers can take away a greater appreciation for the rich blues history that helps define Austin, and especially East Austin, Texas. You know, the city, as many know, especially those who had the opportunity to visit it, it famously bills itself as the live music capital of the world. But the legacy of East Austin's blues scene is not always recognized when people think of Austin today. You know, if there's any, like, one genre that is closely connected to Austin, it's, you know, sort of the outlaw or cosmic cowboy movement, you know, country music, right? But we usually don't think of Austin as a major site for blues music, but it has a really rich blues history. In fact, you know, East Austin, when the blues scene was really hopping over there, artists like B.B. King, Bobby Blue Bland, Ike and Tina Turner, you know, very well-established, internationally known musicians would stop and perform in little juke joints out in East Austin when they were, you know, on tour and moving from one major city to another. Austin was a major stop on that, what was known as the Chitlin' Circuit at the time. So, you know, that's something I hope readers will just take away an understanding of, that because it, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's been published on the blues scene, like in Chicago and the Mississippi Delta, of course, but not so much on Austin or even Texas. And second, I hope this article contributes to our understanding of authenticity itself, particularly the ways in which it can be used as a sort of discourse of resistance by marginalized communities, which is one of the things I talk about in the piece. And I think there are a number of ways in which we can study authenticity, and this is something that, you know, disciplines all across the academy or have been writing about for a long time now. But I hope this article helps us see how oral history is especially well suited to studying authenticity.
Any good oral historian, and I hope I am one, leaves their narrator with the last word. Even though this isn't officially an oral history interview, Roger, what else would you like to say?
Well, I think I'd just like to say thank you so much, Troy. I appreciate the opportunity to sit down and chat with you about my article. It's a real thrill for me, and I'm excited about the sort of digital initiatives that the Oral History Review has been pursuing, and I think it's really helping to bring the work that oral historians are doing to new audiences in a number of different forms outside of traditional print mediums, and I think that's important. You know, print is always going to be, it's always going to be there, and it always should be there, but it's great that we're, you know, as a field, we're starting to take advantage and explore these digital options we have now to bring the work to larger audiences and in different forms. So I just want to say thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to sit down and chat with you today.
Well, Roger, you're welcome. And it's, you know, pieces like yours that I think are going to help us with this continued push to get more multimedia in the Oral History Review. And if we can help any more of your colleagues realize that this piece isn't about antiquing, then this podcast will serve a dual purpose.
Absolutely, and it's I'm especially excited that we were able to, you know, post the two songs with the piece as well. It's, you know, great music from these artists.
Yeah. Right. This should be the case that Oxford University Press will allow free access, at least for a bit, to to that article, so people get to read your piece and listen to those two great songs at the end.
Wonderful.
So Roger, I want to thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Troy. It's a pleasure being here.